Hi everyone, welcome to another Tabit Masterclass. It's great to see you here. My name is Julian Garner. I'm the Chief Executive of Tabit and really pleased to be introducing our speaker, Tony Stockman, who's our Chair of Trustees for Tabit. So it's great that Tony has come to speak to us. And this is developing the idea of our coding computer group, which is looking to build on the roots of Tabit, really, which started with computer programmers back in the 1960s, believe it or not. And so we're getting back into programming and running some sessions on programming. Tony did a very good masterclass at our Tabit conference back in September, and so it's this is a follow-on from that, and looking at some programming ideas and how to get into it. So really pleased you can join us, and now I'm going to hand over to Tony Stockman.
Okay, thanks, Julian. So I just want to explain how I want to try to run this session. You're not actually going to be running the Python programs that I've prepared, simply because the chances are you've all got slightly different setups, and it takes some time to actually download and install Python. And by the time we got everyone to do that and actually get it running properly, it would probably take at least all of the time available for the session. So I'm not attempting to do that, but I hope to provide you with enough knowledge and resources for you to be able to go on and do that yourselves. There's a book, so there's a main tutorial document which I'll tell you how to get to in a moment. But that tutorial document is not really meant for during the session. It's meant for you to go back to after the session and then to follow through, going through it. It actually contains a lot of what I'm going to say during the session and fills out in a number of places rather more details. And at the end of it, it gives a reference to a very good book which is available on Audible, which is provides quite a good introduction to the Python programming language. And as well as the audio book, when you buy it, you get a PDF file which has not only just all of the code from the book, but all of the text from the book as well, which is particularly useful because the reader, not unusually, sadly, when they're reading out chunks of code, neglects to give, in some cases, every open bracket and every closing bracket, and anybody who, and maybe open and closing quotes. And anybody who's ever done any programming will know that it's absolutely essential to have all of those read out and spelt out to make it clear exactly what's there. So you get the audio book, and generally the reader does a good job, but you've actually got the text of the book and the all of the code snippets as well. So you can check exactly what brackets and quotes need to be there in any given program. So that's the tutorial document. I wanted to keep to a minimum, though, the number of things you need to reference during this session. So what I've done is put all of the programs together into one file, which is called All Programs, and it's got a .rtf extension, which it should, if you've got Word on your system or WordPad, then you should be able to open it in either of those programs. So all I need you to do to be able to follow along is to get that program. I'll tell you how. And oh, sorry, to get that file, download it, make sure you know where it's going on your system, and then open it, and that will give you access to all of the code examples that I'm going to cover. Okay, so Julian has very helpfully put the web address of the of where to get the documents from for the session in the Zoom chat. So if you're familiar with using the chat feature in Zoom, then if you could carry on and just get it from there, Click on the link and it'll take you to the page where the programs are. And just for the time being, if you just download the all programs file. For those of you who are not familiar with using the chat feature in Zoom, I'll give you the web address now. It is as follows: https colon slash slash www dot tavip.org dot uk forward slash python python forward slash. Okay, so if you could go to that web address, you will find a page which has the flyer for this session that you may have read in Julian's email announcing the session, and underneath that are all of the programs and the tutorial file. Okay, so if you're not able to get hold of that for some reason, I still think there'll be value in you listening to the stuff that as I'm going to talk through, and you can then hopefully pick up the files after the session. But if you can get hold of particularly that all programs file now, that will enable you to follow along with the code examples I'm going to go through. Okay, so if you can all, or those of you that want to, try to go to that web address and get the all programs document. I'll give you a few minutes to do that. If you can shout out if you're having problems with it, then we'll try to help.
While people are doing it, may I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Vaguely, how similar is Lua?
I don't think it's particularly similar, but I've really not seen very much Lua, so I'm not speaking from a position of much knowledge on that. Are you fairly familiar with Lua?
No, it's just there are things I do with game sound packs and things that
Yeah.
Lua knowledge might be helpful with.
Okay. Yeah. What I can tell you as far as gaming, writing games in Python is concerned, is there's a particular library, as you might expect, called Pygame, Pygame, that people pull in, and that provides obviously a lot of game-specific functionality.
A lot of the sound packs we have for MUDs and things use Lua, so.
Yeah, no, okay, sure. Yeah, as I mentioned in the blurb for this session, a lot of the real power in Python, it comes from the libraries that have been written for it. We're not really going to be using those at all in this particular session. But the idea of this session is it kind of paves the way to give you enough knowledge so that later, if there's demand, we could run a session about using those libraries to do more sort of real world like tasks in Python, which, given the fact these libraries exist, you can actually achieve in a very small number of lines of code usually. Okay,
Okay, just to butt in, Jeff here. I've finally got there. I've
oh great, okay, good, thanks Jeff,
got about
excuse me.
29 windows open, that's all.
Yeah, sure. That's my issue as well at the moment. All right. Okay, so I'm going to start going through. I've got a kind of script I'm going to work my way through, and periodically it refers to one of these listings, and at that point I'll go to the all programs document and talk through the relevant part of that. So Start with the very basics. For people completely new to programming, programmers, when they're writing programs, communicate with the machine using a programming language. And each language is made up of a number of statements. And so any given program is written using statements that belong to a particular language. And quite often you might choose a language because it is a good match for the task you're trying to, for the program you're trying to write. I'll come on to that in a little more detail in a second. So examples of languages which you've probably heard of are things like Java, JavaScript, Python, which we're going to be using here, C, C++, C Sharp, SQL. And each of those languages, they're all of those are very well known languages. Each of them has strengths and weaknesses. But all of them, apart from SQL, really, are general purpose languages. SQL is an exception in that it is used specifically to communicate with databases. But all of the others are general purpose languages. There are actually hundreds and hundreds of different languages. People have written languages specifically to communicate with particular types of machines or to run on particular hardware. Jeff mentioned earlier that he's written in assembler. He's written assembler code, which is code that is written at a very low level in order to interact very efficiently, very rapidly with a particular machine or a particular architecture. And it's actually quite fun doing that because you get to learn a certain amount about the underlying hardware. In some situations, you can actually write programs involving more than one language. For example, you might have a situation where you write some of the code in Python, and then you need to interact with a database. And so you use some of the SQL language to do that because that's specifically what SQL does. And then you go back into Python to do the rest of the coding. In terms of how long programs tend to be, well, that varies enormously. You can have programs that are sort of only half a dozen to 10 lines long that achieve a great deal if they pull in functionality using libraries of pre-written code, for example, as I mentioned, you can do in Python. For example, a Python program to do some machine learning tasks, really quite complicated machine learning tasks with some very sophisticated mathematics behind it, can maybe only take 15 to 20 lines of code, but there's an awful lot going on under the bonnet when you look at the detail of that. And actually, one of the slightly scary things is that it's relatively easy to learn how to do that without knowing the underlying assumptions behind the maths that's going on in the machine learning, which is one of the concerns about the potential misuse of machine learning within organizations. I'm going to be looking then at individual statements within languages. And what I'm doing really is I'm taking out generic statements, in other words, statements that belong to almost all languages. In other words, if you take a given statement, I'm going to look at, say, an if statement. Nearly all languages have an if statement. It may look different in different languages. The syntax of a statement can vary from language to language, but the essential functionality is broadly the same. The if statement in Python, for example, doesn't look like the if statement in most other languages, but its functionality is really quite similar. So I'm going to first talk about, I'm going to take each statement in turn, or maybe sometimes take a couple together. And I'm going to first talk about it in general, what it looks like in different languages typically, and what it's used to do. And I strongly suggest you just listen to that rather than trying to read anything as I talk it through. And then we'll use one or more of the listings from the All Programs document to provide examples. Initially, there'll be just code snippets to just illustrate the use of the statement, but towards the end, we'll get on to a couple of slightly more sophisticated complete programs which show the use of statements in context. So, just to repeat again, I'd recommend that you keep the All Programs document open and follow along with each listing as I go through. But when I'm just introducing a statement and talking about it in more general terms, just listen. And then I'll come to the relevant listing or listings for that statement. Don't worry if you don't understand everything in the listing when you first look through it. There's a lot of detail here. There's a lot of brackets and quotes and commas. And you may not understand the use of them all in the first instance, but you will have the tutorial document to fall back on. You'll have the recording of this session, and you'll also probably most usefully have the book that's recommended at the end of the tutorial document. So, just for any latecomers, that book is available on Audible, and you get a PDF of all the text and the code snippets when you buy that book, and it's referenced at the very end of the tutorial document. Okay, so I'm going to use Python because Python is relatively easy to follow if you're not used to programming, and it's also extremely popular. I mean, it's used to do all sorts of things from scientific computing through to writing games, websites, interacting with the web, databases, and spreadsheets. So it's a truly all-purpose language. It's quite often taught as a first programming language in universities, and it's certainly widely used in industry. Okay, so I'm going to come on now to start talking about specific individual statements. The first statements you'll often come across in a language are a begin statement, and related to that is an end statement. These statements are used, surprise, surprise, to signal the beginning of a chunk of code or the beginning of a program. And the end statement signals the end of that block of code or end of a program. But I'm not going to talk about these any further, actually, because Python doesn't have them at all. It gets by with other mechanisms. You won't see begin and end statements in Python, but many languages do have them, particularly Java, Pascal, many of the structured languages, as they're called, which are structured literally in terms of these blocks of code that have a begin at the start and an end statement at the end. So, coming on now to statements that do actually exist in Python and in pretty much every other language. If you think about it, any program pretty much needs to read something from somewhere. It needs to either read information from a file or a database, or it needs to get input from the user. So, those statements to get information into the program are usually called either input or read statements. And as I said, the source of the information is either directly from the user typing information into a terminal, into a laptop, or possibly these days into a mobile device. And if you think about it as well, when the program reads in the information, it needs to put that information somewhere in order to sort of keep it so that it can reference it again. And that somewhere is called a variable, and we'll be coming on to talk about variables very shortly. And then, similarly, obviously, to be useful to anybody, a program needs to be able to put information out to other people or into a file. It needs to be able to output information. So, in most programming languages, that statement is either called an output statement or a write statement. So it will either output or write information either to a file or directly so the user can view it on a screen or possibly print out onto a printout. And again, if you think about it, if the program's going to write information, it's got to get that information from somewhere. And the way it does that is that the information it's going to write or output is stored in one or more of these variables that we'll be coming on to talk to in a moment. Finally, before we look at our first listing, comments are an important feature in pretty well all programming languages. What they are used to do is actually to document the code, both for the reader, somebody who's not familiar with a program, so that they can understand what it's doing, and also for the author. If you write a program that's several hundred lines long and you come back and look at it a week later, the chances are you'll have a real problem on your hands trying to remember exactly how it works. But if you include comments in the code to explain how it works, it makes that process so much easier. And it certainly makes it easier for somebody picking up that program who's maybe been given the job of maintaining it, of improving it, or enhancing it in some way in the future, especially if they were not the original author. So that's the role of comments. Comments in Python are indicated by the number sign, and we're going to see a lot of these. So try to get used to the fact that if you read a hash sign, a number sign, or hear the word number as you're going through code, then what that tells you is what follows on that line is not code, it's just text. And it's not executed in any way, it's purely there to explain what's going on. And you'll see situations in some of these examples where you have a piece of code, and then that's followed on the same line by the hash or number sign, and then a comment. And so it's particularly important there to remember that the stuff on the line before the number sign is a Python statement, and then what follows after the number sign is just a comment. It's not executable code. Okay. Any questions about any of that before we go to our first listing? Okay, so those of you who've got access to it, if you could go to the All Programs document, and at the very top, we've got our first listing. Just to say initially a little bit about the All Programs document. So the All Programs document includes all the programs that I'm going to cover in this session. In fact, there could easily be more than we've got time to cover in this session, but you've got them all there in any case. When we finish with a listing, then I'll typically go back and start introducing the next statement rather than just going on to the next program. But at the point you want to go to the next program, probably the easiest thing to do is simply to search for three asterisks, star, 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 because what I've done is before the start of each new program, I put three stars and then said listing on the same line and then the number. So it typically reads star, 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 listing two. And then it may say a bit about what listing two does on the same line. So to jump to the next program listing, you just simply search for three stars. Okay, so now to start looking at listing one, simple input and output. So the first thing we come across is actually a comment. So we've got number. Oh, I'm going to say this how Jaws says it to me, but your screen reader may render it in some different way. It may say something like hash, or obviously you may be looking at it using a magnifier or optical character recognition. So it says ask the number, oh, sorry, ask the user for their name. So all that is saying is it's explaining to the reader what this next thing does is gets the name of the name of the user. And then we have the next statement, which is name equals input. And then in brackets and quotes, what is your name? So what this will do is it will print that text, what is your name? And it will take input and store it in the variable name. Okay, so what we do in Python is that we put the name of the variable first that's going to contain the information, and then we have an equal sign, and then the sort of query to the user, what is your name? And that's done in an input statement, indicating that it's going to read some input from the user. Okay, so that will fetch whatever the user types in as their name and store it in the variable called name. Then the next thing we have is another comment, which is shown by the fact there's a number sign, and then it says print a greeting message. So that's just a comment which is saying the next line that's coming along is going to be to print a greeting to the user. Okay, and then we have a print statement. So that's an example of an output statement. And then there's a text string in quotes which says hello in quotes. And then plus name, which is the variable that stores this person's name. So the net effect of that is going to be to say hello or print hello to the user and then print their name. So, as in this example, if when they saw that input statement asking them to put in their name, they put in the name Alice, then what this statement will do is say is print out to them hello Alice, because it's printing what's in quotes and then the variable the value of what's in the variable name, which is Alice if they put in the name Alice. And you can see that in the example run that's shown in the couple of lines after that print statement. Okay, any questions at all about any of that? So here, what we've seen is the use of very simple input and output statements to read in somebody's name and then print a greeting, hello, and print out their name in response. So that we're here, we have the use of a variable which we called name, which is used to store the value of the name that the user entered in response to the request to enter their name. So variables in most languages, including Python, usually start with a letter and then consist of a number of letters and numbers. There are some important kind of rules of thumb. They're not hard and fast rules, but they are quite important in terms of good programming practice. Firstly, it's really helpful to you and to others in a sort of development environment if you choose meaningful names for variables. So here we've called the variable that's going to store somebody's name, we've called it name. We might have called it first name if we were specifically asking for somebody's first name. Or we've called it name, so they might have actually entered their full name. The point is, it's actually really quite useful to call a variable something that relates to something meaningful in terms of what it's going to store. We could have just called this variable A, and we could have said A equals and then input what is your name. And that would have stored the value of somebody's name in the variable A. The only problem is if we come back to it later and we're looking at code and it's considerably more complicated than this example, then we might have a problem remembering what is it that this variable A stores. And that's can be the root of many problems if you choose names for variables that really aren't meaningful. So really important to choose names of variables which are meaningful in terms of what they're being used to store. Another really important rule of thumb, maybe not quite so obvious when you first start programming, but in general, it's a really bad move to try to store two pieces of information in the same variable at the same time. For example, you might initially be inclined to try to store someone's name and age all in the same variable. You might think, well, I'm making really efficient use of storage space by doing this, but actually, that is terrible programming practice, because the two things can be mixed up. It may not be clear where one begins and the other ends in some cases. And you may often want to use them quite separately. So another really important rule of thumb is only store one thing in one variable at a time. When computers were very much slower and storage space was at much more of a premium, programmers often used to use this sort of quite bad practice to actually try to save space because the resources available to them in terms of execution time and storage availability were much more limited. But now there's absolutely no reason for doing that unless you were doing it in an incredibly constrained environment, such as a mobile environment where there was particularly a small amount of storage space or executing time available. It's really not conceivable these days that anybody would want to do that. It would be very bad programming practice. In fact, I would suggest that a slightly stronger version of not storing two bits of information in the same variable at the same time is actually to just use one variable to store one thing throughout the lifetime of a program, because you can just use new variables as you wish. There's no limit to the number of variables you use as a general regime. So that really is the best way to go.
Tony, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
It's Julian here. I'm just wondering that it doesn't look like the variable name has any, it hasn't got like a dollar sign or anything in front of it.
No.
Is it possible to get it confused with an instruction? So you've got name equals input. So you might, if you don't know all the all the sort of instruction names like input or print,
Yeah.
then you might
Yeah.
accidentally use a variable that's one of like a print equals. You might
Yeah.
get
I
confused.
know. I know what you're getting at. This is some of the sort of flexibility of Python. Other languages actually constrain you either to specifically define up front what the variables are that you're going to use, or as you say, some languages might actually require you to prefix every variable with some special character like the dollar sign. But you don't have to do that in Python. If you used the way I think Python sorts this out is by the context. In other words, if it comes before the equal sign, it's a variable. If it comes after the equal sign, it's likely to be an instruction.
Right.
Okay. But you're absolutely right. There is potential there for confusion. I haven't put it to the test, but if you actually, for example, use the word print or some other instruction in place of a variable, then I think there's a fair chance that the Python environment would flag that up and say bad use of a keyword or something like that. Okay. So I want to move on now to listing two, which is about variables. So going back to the old programs document. So again, we start off with a comment. This program demonstrates how to use variables in Python. Well, actually, the previous program did that to some extent, but this does it in a little bit more detail. So again, another comment, assign values to variables. So here we're going to use a number of variables actually to store bits of information. So the first one is name equals and then Alice in quotes. It could have been another name. Age equals 30. Height equals 5.6. And just to make it clear, we got a comment on that line after that assignment to say that height, to say that that is the height in feet, the units here are feet. And then we've got something slightly different, a variable called is underscore student equals true. Now, this may be something people haven't come across before. Well, obviously, if you've not done any programming, you won't have done, but even if you have done a bit of programming, you may not have come across this before. This is student, is underscore student, and is an example of a Boolean variable. Now, a Boolean variable is a variable that can only take on one of two values in most languages. It can either be true or false. And here we're setting is underscore student to be true. But we could obviously equally have set it to be false. Okay, so that's assigned each of these variables a value. And now we're going to print them. So there's a comment saying that that's what we're going to do. And then we have a series of print statements. Okay, so, and then a series of fairly straightforward print statements where we say print and then in quotes what the name, what the variable actually stores. Sorry, the item that we're printing out, and then close quotes, and then the variable. And what will be stored, sorry, what will be printed out then is not name, but the actual value of the variable. In the case of name, it'll be Alice. So that first print statement, it'll say what will actually be printed out would be name and then Alice. And then similarly, the next print statement will print out age, because age is in quotes, and then the value of the variable age. So what will be printed out will be age 30. Okay, and then the next one prints out height, and then height in feet, and then we've got the word feet, which will be printed out as well, just to indicate that the value of the variable height that's just been printed out, is its unit is feet. And then
Tony.
finally, we print out the value of this Boolean variable. So is student quote is the name of the variable, and then we have the variable itself. So what would be printed there is the value of the variable. So what would be printed out here is student true. Okay,
Yes.
so that's just doing some simple printing. So was there a query there?
Yes, David Taylor.
Yeah, hi.
Why did the first one have plus signs in between the different parts of the printout and these ones don't?
You mean the printing of the name?
Yeah, when you printed the name in the first example, it had plus signs between where it said hello,
Oh,
Alice,
see.
whatever.
Yeah, the effect seems to be the same, but that plus is simply a way of indicating you're adding that string, that sorry, adding that variable to the literal string that you're printing out. But the two statements seem to do exactly the same thing as far as I can see.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll come on shortly to the difference between print and the printf statement. And the printf statement seems to deal with more complicated combinations of printing out literal strings and variables. But for simple cases like the one you pointed out, you seem to be able to get away with a simple print statement, or as you say, there's a version where you have the plus sign to specifically add the variable onto the literal string that's being printed out. I don't really know why there is what the significance of that is. They seem to achieve the same thing.
Thanks.
Okay, so we've next got some calculations on these variables just to show the kind of manipulations you could do. So we can have a new variable. Sorry, next year age. So that's going to be the age. We're going to store the age that somebody's going to be next year, and then we get that simply by adding one to the current age. Then we have the height in inches, which is obtained by multiplying the height in feet by 12. And then we print out these two altered variables. Oh, sorry, not so much altered variables, but the new variables that we've calculated by performing those simple bits of maths on the original variables. So what we're doing in each of those cases is assigning to a new variable the calculated version of the old variable. So height in inches is going to store the height in feet times 12. Next year, obviously, next year's age is adding one to the current age, and we'd simply print those out. Okay, so going back briefly to introduce this next listing. Oh, actually, yeah, just a quick aside. Just as a general query to people, in computing systems, we often need to store people's how old people are. Do you have any thoughts on the best way of doing that? And can you explain why? If you were writing a program which needs to represent how old somebody is, what's the best way to do that?
Date of birth.
Yes. Why?
Because if you come back a few months later, if you just ask how old they are, they might have had a birthday and then it's wrong.
Yes. Hello. Yeah.
I'm not sure of your name. My apologies.
Sorry, Tony.
Hi, Tony. It's Adara. So wouldn't you put your age, technically speaking, in integers? Because so that you, and yes, your age does change every year, but I would have thought it would have been in ints, no?
Yeah, it's very likely to be stored in a variable of type integer. That's right. We are going to actually just about to talk about different data types. But yeah, I mean the first answer, which I think was Julian, is
Yes.
kind of correct. But look at it the other way around from the point of view of maintaining that program. If you store somebody's age, then as you say, it changes. So somehow, every year, that program needs to be updated. Age needs to become equal to age plus one. So either every time someone has a birthday, or maybe as a job lot at some point each year, these variables all need to be updated. Now, actually, probably rather than talking about variables in a program, the chances are that this information is going to be stored in a database, in fact, or possibly in a spreadsheet. But no matter where it's stored, what you really don't want to have is the overhead of having to update everybody's ages each year. So, yeah, the way to get around that is to store everybody's date of birth. And then pretty well every language that you'll come across will have some way of getting at today's date and for that matter, the current time. So you can then calculate somebody's age by taking today's date and subtracting from it their date of birth, and then maybe a little bit of other maths involving numbers like 365 to get the number of years. But basically, you then save yourself the job of having to update the database every year simply to update people's ages. So, invariably in computing, when we want to store how old people are, we simply store their dates of birth and then calculate their age as required by getting the current date and using and subtracting from it their date of birth. It's an important lesson to learn, and one I've had to explain to hundreds of students, where they sort of create a database and they'll have a student number, say student name, age, and so on. And you need to explain to them that no, actually, age isn't going to work because obviously it does need to be updated. So you store people's date of birth instead.
It will depend on the context, won't it? Because what you say is completely true, that if you have a database application, you will do that. You will put the date of birth. When you're actually using that information, you may very well want to have a, shall we call it a working variable, which is a person's current age. You might call it current underscore age. And you may be asking questions, having done the computations, as you said, from the birth date, You know what the person's current date is. You stick that in a variable, which we'll call a working variable, as I say. And you may want to ask questions such as, well, is this person old enough to get a driving license for a car? So if age is greater than or equal to 17 and so on. So that is where you would have a working integer representation.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And it's a good distinction to draw. These variables that we're looking at in programs don't generally exist before the program is run, and they don't persist, they don't continue to exist when the program stops running. They are just used within the program. So, as you say, absolutely, having calculated somebody's current age, you need to put it somewhere because you presumably need it to do to use it in various ways. And so in the program itself, it could be stored, well, it would be stored in a variable, which, yeah, for argument's sake, could be of type integer. And you would use it, and it's fine to use it within the program. And it may even be fine, supposing you've got a number of programs which you know are all going to be run on the same day. You might store it in some kind of temporary database or temporary table somewhere, so that programs later that day that are definitely going to run later that day can access it. But you need to be really pretty sure that it is always going to be later that day that those programs use it. Otherwise, you know, there could be mistakes. But yeah, there is absolutely room for both types of representation. The current age would be used within the context of a specific program, whereas the date of birth would be the permanent way in which you record how old someone is, or, well, obviously effectively when they were born, so that you can then get at their current age as and when you require it in any given program. Okay. So as has been mentioned, we have variables that can be of different types. So, for example, age would typically be an integer because you know, that's how we think of ages. It's always a whole number. Well, I suppose you might say somebody's 10 and a half, maybe, but generally speaking, we think of age as being an integer. So, most languages support a number of very commonly found different types of data. Some of those are integer, as we've seen. Float, sometimes referred to as real. So, for example, when we had height in feet, which was 5.6, that would be stored as a floating point number, or a real number, as it's called in some languages. It's called float in Python. And then another type of data is character or string. It's known as string in Python, which is a string of characters. So we used a variable of type string to store people's names. And then another very common type of variable is date, because very often we're dealing with dates in programs. And then another one, which again we've already seen, is Boolean, where we want to sort of simply represent whether something is true or false. So coming on now to listing three. Which illustrates the use of different types. So at the start of this, we've got some text which isn't part of Python code because it's not actually commented, it's just written out, it's just text, it's not part of Python code. So that's where it says, here's a simple Python script, etc. And then we have each one listed on a line starting with a star. Now, that's not Python code because for that to be valid Python code, that star would actually have to be a number symbol. So we're going to have an integer, floating point, string, boolean, and list, which is another one which we'll see using context in a second. So then we start the actual program. So we first got a comment. So it starts with a number sign and then integer. So that's simply saying, here comes the use of an integer. So age equals 25. So that's obviously a simple integer. And then we print out that we're going to print out the value of somebody's age, and that is of type int, short for integer, and then we close the quotes, and then we have age, which is the variable name, and what will be printed is the actual value in that variable, i.e. 25. So what will be printed out here is age int 25. And then we next have a comment saying we're now going to show use of a floating point data type. So we assign a height of 5.9, and then we print out the height and the fact that it's of type float, floating point, and then we're going to print the variable itself, or print the value of that variable, which is 5.9. And then we have an example of a string. So we assign the value Alice to this string. And then print the fact that it's a name and it's a string and the value of Alice. And then Boolean. We assign the value true to is student. And then we print out the fact that is we're going to print out the variable is student and that it's of type bool, and then the value of the variable, which is true. Okay, then we come to list, which we haven't come across before. So lists are actually quite interesting and potentially very powerful. So here, what we're doing is assigning a list of different items to a variable called list. So we're calling the list fruits. So it's going to store a list of different fruits. And why I say this is quite powerful is, we're going to assign a number of different values, which are all going to be stored in this list. And I mean, yes, we've just got a few values here, but we could have actually quite a lot of values we store in a list. I mean, there are programs that deal with lists that are hundreds or even potentially thousands of items long. And then we print it out. And so we say print and then fruits, which is the name of the variable and the fact that it's of type list. And then afterwards, we print the actual variable itself, or sorry, the value of the variable. And again, this is quite powerful because just for that one word list, we'll get that list of fruits, which yes, obviously here is quite short, but it could have been much longer. Okay, then the next part of this listing simply shows we have a way of getting at. If we don't know the type of a variable, we have a function in Python that enables us to find out what type of variable it is, and that is the type function. So functions we will talk about later, although I don't think we're going to have time to get onto that tonight, but it is covered in the tutorial document, and there is a listing. I think it's listing 11 that has examples of both modules and functions. So here we have a print statement. Whenever you see backslash n in a print statement, it simply means take a new line. And then we're simply going to print out the phrase variable types. And then we're going to print out the literal string type of age, and then after that we are printing type and then in brackets age. Ages in brackets. So what that is doing is it's using a function called type to find out for us what type of variable, what data type is the variable age. And as we know, it's integer. So the effect of this print statement will be to print out type of age and then integer. So this enables us to find out the type of a variable if we don't already know it. And then similarly, we do the same for height, which will find out the type of height is floating point, of course. So that will print out type of height and then float. And then we do the same for name, which is string. And then type of is student, which is Boolean. And then type of fruits, which is list. And so and then we have a brief summary saying what this code actually does. So it declares variables of different types, prints the values, and then uses the type function to enable us to find out if we didn't know what is the type of each variable. Okay, so going back to talk about the print statement, first of all. Oh, yeah, just to point out something actually here. Just going back to the variables of different types, when it says that the listing declares different variables of different types, I'd kind of dispute that a little bit because actually it's not really declaring them in the sense that that's understood in many languages. We're simply assigning values to these variables, and the variable takes on the type of the value that it's been assigned. So age equals 30, then the data type of variable age is integer by dint of the fact that it was given a value of 30, which is an integer. In other languages, we do this much more explicitly. We would declare the variable age and specify that it is of type integer. Okay, and that would be a statement that would appear near the top of the program before we actually assigned any value to the age variable. So again, this is kind of some of the flexibility of Python, which allows you simply to grab hold of a variable and stick a value in it, and that then the value the type of that value defines the type of variable that we're dealing with. But in other languages where we're explicitly required to declare variables up front and specify what type of variable they are, those languages are better at trapping certain types of errors because, for example, if we assign the wrong type of value, say a floating point value, to a variable that's only supposed to hold an integer, then those types of language will catch that as an error. Whereas Python, if you don't declare variables up front, won't do that. And that can lead, obviously, to problems if you're storing things in variables that are not actually supposed to store them. So there are languages which are, for example, Java. Many other languages where you are required, Pascal again comes to mind, Algol 60, where you need to declare variables up front and say what type they are before you even go near assigning values to them. Okay, so now moving on to the variations on the print statement. So if you see a simple print statement, then that's what it is. It's a simple print statement. In other words, you can print a literal string. And in simple cases we've seen, you seem to be able to include a simple variable in a print statement as well. Printf allows you to do more complicated things in a print statement. In particular, you can print literal strings, you can print variables, and you can do calculations on variables as well. So to see an example of this, we look at listing four. I'm going to skip over the bit that says let's break it down, actually, at the start of listing four, because that basically just says what I've just said. So going on to the point where we assign the value of 30 to age. So before that, it simply has the text more powerful. And then it says age equals 30. And then print f name is age. So that has the effect of printing Alice is 30 years old. So here we're mixing two literal strings and in the middle of that printing out a variable, i.e. the Alice's age. So we're mixing variables and literal strings when there's in the same printf statement. And then we have another example where we're doing a calculation on age. So in 5 years, name, whatever stored in the value of name will be, and then age plus five. So that's the kind of thing that the printf statement allows you to do calculations or some kinds of manipulations on the variables within the print statement itself. You can't do that within an ordinary print statement. How we're doing for time. Okay. I'm going to try to cover at least listings five and six, which use arrays, and also a very important statement called the for statement. I think I'll cover listing five and then perhaps leave listing six for you to look at because it's very similar, and try to fit in doing the if statement within Python before we will probably be near to finishing by then. Okay, so I've now finished with listing four, the difference between print and printf. I want to talk now about more complicated data structures and the ability to execute the same lines of code a number of times. So to take that last thing first, often in programming, we want to execute the same lines of code a number of times. So, for example, calculating the average and total sales values per month for each separate product for an organization. A common way of doing this is to use a statement called the for statement, which is how you do this in Python, and it's also how you do it in various versions of BASIC. So, in very broad terms, an outline of the code to do this might look like, for all products from 1 to n, where n is the total number of products, and then within that for loop, you say, calculate average sales per month for that product, and then calculate total values of sales per month. Print out both the average and the total values of sales, and then you have a statement which says next product. So within each time you execute this loop, for any given product, you calculate the average sales and the total sales, and you print those out. And then the next product statement says, go back to the top of the loop, take the next product, and do the same for that product. And you go round and round this loop until you've gone through all of the products, because remember the for statement said, for all products from 1 to n, where n is the total number of products. So you go through all of the products. When you've done all n products, what will happen is that for loop will be examined again, and it'll say, well, we've done all n products, so we've no more products to do. So what happens then is the code execution moves on to the statement immediately after the next product statement. The next product statement, therefore, is important because it tells the computer that that's the end of the set of statements needed to be executed each time within the for loop. And it also tells the loop to move on to the next product, obviously, until there are no more products. So the for statement itself checks each time for the next product, and if we've done it for all of the products, it terminates the execution of the loop, and the program carries on executing from the statement immediately after the next product statement. As it happens, though, Python doesn't have a next statement. That's because Python makes quite heavy use of indenting. So code that is to be considered as being within the for loop is indented. Now, indenting in Python is by convention done by for spaces. So if the next four statements in the that following the for loop are indented by four spaces, then it's taken to mean that you require th those are the statements that are being repeated by the for loop. On the other hand, if there are three statements that are indented by four spaces, and then the for statement is left justified, then Python assumes that the loop iteration ends at the third statement, and the fourth one will only be executed after the loop finishes. And that's why indentation in Python is actually really important. And it's really important to check that it's correct, because actually the meaning of the code completely changes depending on how it's indented. Okay, briefly to introduce the idea of arrays. Often we want to store a set of things together, all that are all of the same type. One reason for doing that is that so that we can process them in a for loop, rather like what we've just done, we could have an array of products, for example. But there are lots of other reasons you might want to store things in arrays as well. So the way we do this in many programming languages is in an array. So an array is like a set of variables, all of the same type, that are to be stored together. So we often, though, want to get an individual element within an array. So in Python, arrays start from zero. So supposing we've got an array of products, so if we want to store 10 products, the way that would be stored in an array in Python is that suppose we call our array products. So products open bracket zero close brackets would be the first element in the array, and the 10th product in the array would be stored in product open bracket nine close brackets. Now, the number in brackets is referred to as the index of the array. It's a way of indexing a specific element within that array, and it's the way we can get at individual elements in the array. Okay, so listing five shows an example of using arrays, including with a for statement. So if you're following in the All Programs document, if you go to listing five, so we import array. Array is a built-in type within Python, which is very useful. It's exactly obviously what we need if we want to use arrays. So if you want to create a simple array of integer values, we use the statement after the comment saying that that's what we're going to do. So we say numbers equals array, and then the word array again and I. What that means is it's an array of integers. Okay, so the I there specifically identifies that this array is going to be used to store integer values. And then we have the list of elements that's going to be stored. So this array has five values, and the zeroth element in the array numbers is going to store the number 10. And the number fourth element, which remember corresponds to the actual fifth one in the list, is going to store the value 50. So if we want to just print out the array, we can simply say, and then we might say original array, as it does in the example there. And then to actually do that, we use a for loop. So the for loop in Python for this particular task has this format for num in numbers. So what this num value is going to do is go through all of the elements in the array from 0 to 4, and we're going to print the value of num. And because it's been referenced as for num in numbers, what that's actually going to print out is the value stored in the numth element of the array numbers. So firstly, it will print out numbers, open brackets, zero, close brackets, and then numbers, open brackets, one, close brackets, and so on until it gets to numbers, open bracket, four, close brackets. One really important thing to notice here is that the print statement after the for statement is indented by four spaces. So what that says is that this print statement is going to be executed for each time we iterate round this for loop, which is going to be five times corresponding to the five elements in the array. Okay, so that will print out all of the values in the array called numbers. And then we have an example of accessing a specific element by the index of the array. And then we have print backslash n, which simply, if you remember, it means take a new line. And then elements are index two. And then outside of the quotes, we have numbers, open bracket, two, close brackets. Now remember, two corresponds to actually the third element in the array. So that will print out the value 30. And another important thing to notice is that that print statement is not indented. So that is not part of the loop. There's only one statement that was part of that for loop, and that was that print num statement that came immediately after it, because that was indented by four spaces. But here, this print statement is not indented. It's just a one-off print statement which prints the value in numbers open bracket two close bracket, which happens to be 30. And then we have an example of modifying an element. So we change the value held in numbers open brackets one close brackets from 20 to 25. And then we print out the array the modified version of the array, taking a new line in that print statement. And then we append a new element to the array. We append the number 60. So we can use the append keyword to add a new number to the array. And again, we print out the new version of the array. Again, note the power of these print statements. We're just saying print numbers, and it prints out all of the numbers in the array. Now, this array is small. It now contains only it contains six different values, but that print numbers statement would work no matter how many numbers we elements we actually had in that array. And then we okay, then we remove an element from the array, and we do that by accessing its value, not by accessing its index, but literally by saying remove the number 30. So we don't need to know where in the array the number 30 actually is. We can just remove it by value, which is quite a powerful mechanism. And then there's a summary of what this previous script does. So it shows how to create an array of integers, and then accessing and modifying elements and removing them. Okay, and then there follows a version of the script showing what the output is of each of the print statements. So if you had any problems actually following what was going on in that, this second version of the script includes the outputs for all of the print statements so that you can verify yourself that what is being printed out corresponds to what you'd expect to be printed out. And if it doesn't, then you can look through the code and try to figure out why it is it's different to what you expected. Okay, any questions about any of that? I'm going to skip over the next one, which covers lists, which are very, very similar to arrays. The only real difference is that you can go on adding elements to a list, whereas in most languages, you need to actually say how many elements are going to be in the array when you first start using it. I'll go on to listing seven then, which is an example of an if then else statement in Python, which is a little bit different to how it's done in other languages. So if you could go to listing seven in your all programs document. So just briefly to say before we start this, the way an if statement works in most languages, or in very many languages at any rate, is that there's an if statement which tests a particular condition, and then there is a then keyword, which, if the condition evaluates to true, the then part is executed, and then there is an else component, which, if the condition tested in the original if statement wasn't true, then this else part will be executed. So that's how the if then else statement works in most languages. In Python, it's slightly different. Instead of a then statement, we have an elif statement. And then we have an else part. So the way it works is that the if statement, just as usual, tests a condition. And then the elif part tests a different condition. And then we can have other elif parts which test further conditions. And then finally, we have the else part, which is executed if none of the conditions in the if or the any of the elif parts were true. It's probably easier, to be honest, to just look at an example, which we have here in listing seven. And again, here, keep a lookout for indenting, because within if statements, the statements that fall under each part are indented to indicate that they fall within each part. And again, if they're not properly indented, then the logic of the program can mean something completely different. Sorry, I've just got to get myself to this. Okay, so at the start of this example of if elif else program in or code snippet in listing seven, it's an age category checker. So it's going to print out something different depending on the value of age that's entered. So the first thing we do is get the age from the user. So we have age equals, and the int at the beginning there makes sure that age is assigned an integer value. So if for some bizarre reason somebody typed in 15.5, that int would actually round the value to be an integer. I suspect if they put in 15.5, it would round up to 16, but that depends on the particular implementation of the int function in Python. But that int, what it does is it actually makes sure that it is an integer value that's assigned to the variable age. And then we have our example of an if elif statement. So if age is less than zero, So it's an invalid age, and we put out a message to say so. And note that that print statement is indented because it comes under the if part of the statement. If age is, and then, okay, next elif. So else if age is less than 13. So that first part in the if statement is has kind of handled the fact that if the age is less than zero. So now, when we test if age is less than 13, we know if it's true that the age must fall between zero and 13. Okay, so we print you are a child. And again, that print statement is intended to show the fact that it falls under the elif clause of this statement. And then we have another elif statement if age less than 20. So because we've removed the possibilities in the earlier if and elif statements that the age is less than zero or age is less than 13, we know that this person is, if it falls true with this elif statement, they must be aged between 13 and 19. In other words, their age is either 13 or less than 20, in the range 13 to less than 20. So we print that they're a teenager, and again, that print statement is indented to show it falls within that elif statement. And then elif age less than 20, 60, so that tells us that they're aged between 20 and 60. You are an adult. And again, that print statement's indented. And then finally, we have the else statement. And then this must mean that they're aged over 60 because we've eliminated all of the other options, including less than zero. You are a senior citizen. And again, that print statement is indented to show that it falls under the else clause of the statement. So the if statement checks an initial condition, and then each of the elif statement or clauses test some other condition, and then finally the else statement kind of sweeps everything else up, any other possibilities. In this case, it was the fact that somebody must be aged over 60. And we have some examples of output. Okay. I'm going to cover listing eight in just about 40 words. We've seen the use of white space in Python, in other words, indenting, and how important it is. I'll include in a version of the tutorial document I'll release later how to deal with how to get JAWS and NV access to tell you what's going on in terms of indenting. In JAWS, you can get it to tell you that it's indented. In NV access, you can get it to do it either by beeping at you or by telling you that it's indented. And there's actually a couple of ways of doing that in NV access. And the final thing to say is the equals sign is used in a slightly funny way in Python. If it's one equal sign, what it means is that this value is being assigned to this variable. So if we say name equals Alice in quotes, then we're simply assigning the value Alice to name. But if we have if name equals equals and then Alice in quotes, what it's doing is it's testing whether the value of what's that's stored in the variable name is equal to the constant value Alice. So if you see equals on its own, it's assigning a value to a variable. If you say if you see two equal signs, it's doing a comparison. And that's slightly different in Python. In most languages, equal a single equal sign is used to do both of those things, whereas Python makes a distinction between assigning a value or testing for equality. I'm sorry we've not been able to get through more of the listings. We've effectively got up to listing 8. Listings 9 and 10, I think, are the most interesting in many ways in that they are examples of complete programs testing for whether a triangle, reading in the three sides of a triangle, testing that those three sides make up a valley triangle, and then testing whether the triangle is equilateral, isosceles, or scalene. And that's quite a nice example of a complete program that uses most of the constructs we've looked at so far. And then listings 11 and 12 just look at some further additional values, which we may well cover in a future class. So yeah, sorry it's been a little rushed towards the end. It was always hard to estimate just how far we were going to get. I really hope it's been useful to people. Please feel free to get in touch if I can help with anything subsequent, including setting up Python, which you should do, you referencing the book listed at the end of the tutorial, or with any of the code that appears in the listings. And if I don't know the answer myself immediately, then I'll chase it up for you. Okay, thanks very much all for your attention. And for your questions, and hopefully maybe this is the start of a small series of such classes. Okay, thanks a lot.
Tony, thank you so much. It's been really, really interesting. I've learned a lot about Python programming that I didn't know before, so thank you for that. It was very clear and well structured and very listenable. So thank you. And the center you so people have got the tutorial documents. Did you
Yeah.
say that the book is referenced in at the end of
Yeah,
the
it's at
document? Is
the
that
end
right?
of that, and I put a couple of notes about using the book to follow on from this course
Right.
where I referenced it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. And then if people would like, we're looking at planning further sessions anyway. If people have got any particular topics or ideas for further sessions under this topic of coding and computing, then do let us know. Drop an email to info@tavit.org.uk, or if you want to reach out to Tony with any specific points, then again, use that info email address and I'll forward it on to Tony to get back to you.
Also, can I
Yeah.
just say, Julian, I'd really welcome any feedback because from this point, it's very hard for me to judge how useful this information has been. I've been aware that a couple of people, appear to have been following and understanding, but it's hard to judge it from the point of view of the majority of people. So, feel free to say it wasn't useful because of this, or you had such and such technical problem. Or parts of it you were useful, please provide any feedback that you're able to in order that we can improve future sessions.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Any quick comments before we go from guests?
Just to say thank you, really.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and Jeff here, me too. Thank you.
I've been aware you
Do
guys
echo
have
the
been
same
following.
sentiments. Thank you. I couldn't quite follow up because I did have
Okay,
things to do,
thank
but
you.
yeah, I
Thank
just
you.
wanted to say thank you very much. It was
Good.
quite interesting
I'm conscious it does take a lot of
to
time to prepare these sessions. So, Tony, thank you again for all the time you put into planning and preparing and putting the material together. It's much appreciated.
Oh, great.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay, lovely. Well, thank you all for being here tonight. We'll now call it an evening. Take care and see you again soon. Thanks very much indeed.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Night.
Nice.